Now I'd like to talk about the difference between requests and demands. When we do make requests, it's very important that other people receive them as requests and not as demands. When received as a request, it's a gift because it gives the other person an opportunity to do what we human beings love to do, to contribute to one another's well-being. But we don't like to hear demands. This threatens our autonomy. So what is the difference between a request and a demand? Well, as I'm using the term, a demand is when a person believes that if they don't do what the other person is requesting, that in some way they will be punished, they will be rejected, guilted, shamed. When people see a request as a demand, they have two options, submission or rebellion. Either way, the person requesting what is wanted is perceived as coercive, and the listener's capacity to respond compassionately is diminished. The more we have in the past blamed, punished, or laid guilt trips on others when they haven't responded to our request, the higher the likelihood that our requests will now be heard as demands. We also pay for the use of such tactics by others. To the degree that people in our lives have been blamed, punished, or urged to feel guilty for not doing what others have requested, it's likely that they're going to carry this baggage to every subsequent relationship and hear a demand in any request. Let's look at two variations of a situation. Jack says to his friend Jane, "I'm lonely and would like you to spend the evening with me." Now, is that a request or a demand? The answer is we don't know until we see how Jack treats Jane if she doesn't comply. Suppose she replies, "Jack, I'm really tired. If you'd like some company, how about finding someone else to be with you this evening?" If Jack then remarks, "How typical of you to be so selfish," his request was in fact a demand. Instead of empathizing with her need to rest, he has blamed her for what she says. Consider a second scenario in this same situation. Jack starts saying, "I'm lonely and would like you to spend the evening with me." Jane says, "Jack, I'm really tired. If you'd like some company, how about finding someone else to be with you tonight?" Jack turns away wordlessly. Jane, sensing he's upset, says, "Is something bothering you?" Jack, "No." Jane, "Come on, Jack. I can sense something's going on. What's the matter?" Jack, "You know how lonely I'm feeling. If you really loved me, you'd spend the evening with me." Again, instead of empathizing with Jane's needs, Jack now interprets Jane's response that she doesn't love him and that she has rejected him. The more we interpret noncompliance as rejection, the more likely our request will be heard as demands. This leads to a self-fulfilling prophecy, for the more people hear demands, the less they enjoy responding to our requests. On the other hand, we would know that Jack's request had been a genuine request, not a demand, if his response to Jane had expressed a respectful recognition of her feelings and needs. So he might have said to her, "So Jane, you're feeling worn out and need some rest this evening." Now, having given her that empathy, if he wanted to try to get her to see another way that they might have both met their needs and looked for a solution, if she had received the empathy first, she could probably have been willing to look for a solution other than not being with him. We can help others trust that we're requesting, not demanding, by indicating that we would only want the person to comply if the person can do so willingly. Thus we might say, "Would you be willing to set the table?" rather than, "I would like you to set the table." However, the most powerful way to communicate that we are making a genuine request is to empathize with people when, for whatever reason, they don't wish to respond to the request. We demonstrate that we're making a request rather than a demand by how we respond when others don't comply. If we're prepared to show an empathic understanding of what prevents someone from doing as we ask, then by my definition, we've made a request, not a demand. Choosing to request rather than demand does not mean we give up when someone says no to our request. it does mean that we don't engage in persuasion until we have empathized with what's preventing the other person from saying yes. Expressing genuine requests also requires an awareness of our objective. If our objective is only to change people and their behavior or to get our way, then nonviolent communication is not an appropriate tool. Nonviolent communication is designed for those of us who would like others to change and respond only when they can do so willingly and compassionately. The objective of nonviolent communication is to establish a relationship based on honesty and empathy. When others trust that our primary commitment is to the quality of the relationship and that we expect this process will fulfill everyone's needs, then they can trust that our requests are true requests and not camouflage demands. A consciousness of this objective is difficult to maintain, especially for parents, teachers, managers, and others, whose work centers around influencing people and obtaining results. During the initial phases of learning this process, we may find ourselves applying the components of nonviolent communication mechanically without awareness of the underlying purpose. And it's important to be continually conscious that the purpose is not to get what we want, but to create the quality of connection that makes compassionate giving possible. Compassionate giving of a kind that allows everyone's needs to get met. Sometimes, however, even when we're conscious of our intent and express our requests with care, people can still hear a demand, especially if their life has been filled full of demands in the past. And this is particularly true when we occupy positions of authority and are speaking with those who have not had good experiences with people in authority in the past. Once the administrator of a high school invited me to demonstrate to teachers how nonviolent communication might be helpful in communicating with students who weren't cooperating as the teachers would have liked. I was asked to meet with 40 students who had been deemed socially and emotionally maladjusted. I was struck by the way such labels serve as self-fulfilling prophecies. If you were a student who had been labeled this way, wouldn't it give you permission to have fun in school? And wouldn't you be inclined to resist whatever was asked of you if you knew you were thought of as socially and emotionally maladjusted? By putting such labels on people, we tend to act toward them in a way that contributes to the very behavior that concerns us, and then we use this as further confirmation of our diagnosis. Since these students knew they had been classified this way, I wasn't surprised that when I walked in, most of them were hanging out the window hollering obscenities at their friends in the courtyard below. I began by making a request. I had to raise my voice to be heard, and I said, "I'd like you all to come on over here and sit down so I can tell you who I am and what I'd like to do today." About half the students came over. I wasn't clear they had all heard me, so I repeated my request. Now everybody came over and sat down, with the exception of two young men who remained draped over the windowsill. Unfortunately, these two were the biggest ones in the class. "Excuse me," I said to them, "would one of you two gentlemen tell me what you heard me say?" One of them turned toward me and said, "Yeah, you said we had to come over there and sit down." I thought to myself, uh-oh, he's heard my request as a demand. Out loud I said, "Sir," I've learned always to say sir to people with biceps like his, especially when one of them had a tattoo on it. I said, "Would you be willing to tell me how I could have let you know what I was wanting so it wouldn't have sounded like I was bossing you around?" He said, "Huh?" You see, he'd been conditioned to expect demands from authority. He wasn't used to my using a different approach of simply making a request. So I said to him, "How can I let you know what I'm wanting from you so it doesn't sound like I don't care about what you'd like?" He thought for a moment. He said, "I don't know." I said, "Well, what's going on between you and me right now is a good example of what I was wanting us to talk about today. I believe people can enjoy each other a lot better if they can just say what they would like from each other without it being heard that they're bossing the other person. So when I tell you what I'd like, I'm not saying that you have to do it, or I'll try to make your life miserable if you don't." So, how can I tell you what I want in a way that you can trust is just what I'm requesting? To my relief, this seemed to make sense to the young man, who together with his friend came over to join the group. In certain situations such as this one, it might take a while before the person trusts that our requests are requests and not demands. When making a request, it's also helpful to scan our minds for thoughts of the following sort that automatically transform requests into demands. For example, if we have a should in our head, he should be cleaning up after himself. Whatever we ask for is going to probably be a demand. If we're thinking, she's supposed to do what I ask, again, it'll probably be heard as a demand. If I say, I deserve to get a raise, probably what I ask for will be a demand. I'm justified in having them stay later, probably will be heard as a demand. I have a right to more time off. Whatever I request will probably be heard as a demand. When we frame our needs in this way, we are bound to judge others when they don't do as we request. Any time we have words like should, supposed to, deserve, justified, etc.
This concludes session 2. Our program continues with session 3.